All right, so what do you talk about? You've got one shot to teach, to talk to people from sixth grade and up. What are you going to talk about? Jesus is a good answer, yes. Yes. How about some hope? Hope's good, right? It wins presidential elections. So let's talk about hope. Sorry. Let's talk about hope. You just finished a survey of the New Testament adults, right? In this class, I believe. Correct? Do you remember which book talks about hope most? Or what was part of the main theme? I know, I'm testing your skills here. Do you remember? 1 Peter, yes, exactly. 1 Peter is a book that talks a lot about hope. So we're going to be looking at a little bit of, in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 15, 16, depending on our time. 1 Peter chapter 3. Now, you remember adults, now, they just got a lesson on intro to the New Testament. So they've been instructed on stuff, and I'm going to quiz them right now to see if they know. Okay? Are y'all ready for this? Okay. All right, this is a test. Some of you may still have your notes. Some of you are looking at me like, yeah, I got my notes. So who wrote 1 Peter? Start off with an easy one. Let's just kind of warm up a little bit here. Stretch it out. Who wrote the letter? Peter, yeah. Shot in the dark on that one. Shot in the dark. Not quite sure, but I'm guessing Peter. Who did he write it to? This is an open book test. To the tribe scattered. What does verse 1 say? That's always a good place to go. To those scattered abroad. So we're talking about, some of your versions may say aliens or resident aliens. So we're talking about people who are scattered abroad. So when we talk about foreign aliens, we're not talking about people who are native to any of these areas, correct? And we can go into a theological discussion about that, but that's not really the parameters of our talk tonight. So Peter wrote it to the church in Asia, so it's a general letter to those congregations. And do you remember another big theme of what the Peter deals with? Look in, go ahead, y'all remember? Suffering, yes, suffering. I mean, I'm not, okay. I'm not like, yay, suffering. I'm just saying, yeah, I got it right. So suffering. Sounds awkward. Okay, so suffering. Look at verse 6 of chapter 1. Verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. Also in chapter 2, verse 19, he says, for this finds favor for the sake of conscience toward God. A person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. Finds favor to God if we bear up, or bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. Looking for 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for testing as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing so that also at the revelation of His glory you may rejoice with exaltation. Exaltation. So what do we... that's sort of weird. We don't really... typically nowadays we don't rejoice in suffering, do we? It's not something we... depends on, I guess. He's like, eh... depends on what kind of suffering, right? I don't know, maybe. Look at James. What does James say in James chapter 1? Just a few pages back. What was it? Consider it all joy. James is another one of those weird guys, right? Verse 2, James chapter 1, verse 2. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing what? What happens? What's the result of these trials? Patience, building of faith, right? And so that is obviously something that we need to be thinking about. Also, Peter mentions that same thing in verse 7 of chapter 1. So that the proof of your faith being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to the result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. You know the refining process of precious metals, right? A lot of you have studied metallurgy, I'm sure. So the refining process of precious metals, you do what to it? You heat it up. And what happens with all the impurities and all those kind of things? They rise to the top, and then you just scoop them off, that slag that just comes off the top. And then you're left with, have you ever seen metal that's molten and pure? It shines, right? It shines brighter than all that slag that was in there before. And so that can only happen, that only happens in that in those crucible events when we can test, our faith is tested. So James and Peter are talking about a time when they're undergoing suffering. Peter's writing about 64, 65 to 68 AD, so later, and so they're suffering. Now, if you're suffering, are you thinking, yay, suffering, faith? That is not our general reaction, right? That is not the fleshly reaction to suffering. When your hand suffers, what does it do? If it gets burnt, our natural reaction to any kind of suffering is what? To pull back, to pull away from it. How many of you have hit your thumb with a hammer? It hurts. Some of you are like, I don't think I want to admit that. But it hurts, right? It hurts. And then the first thing you do is you grab that, or you stick it in your mouth maybe, whatever you do for consolation, you get away from that pain, all right? Now, obviously, if you sit there and hit your thumb with a hammer, it is not going to get any better, all right? It's not going to. I'm refining my thumb. That is not how that works, obviously, okay? It is not the same situation. But when it comes to spiritual matters, I'm not saying you guys need to go out and run out in the streets and look for suffering, but if you're doing what's right, is the world going to notice? Yes. When David went up against Goliath, had he fought any battles before? Do you remember? The bear and the lion, right? He tested his faith. Right? So before he even gets on the... So he's had his battles, okay, that nobody knew about. And so before he even steps foot on the battlefield, he's tested his faith. All right? He's had his crucible moments in faith. Any of you seen a lion before? In the zoo, right? Behind bars. Because lions and humans don't play well together, right? Okay, so have you ever chased after one to save another animal, or chased one off to save a flock of animals? In one text, he says he grabbed it by the beard. There's some people I wouldn't want to grab by the beard, right? So here is David. He's tested, and that's what he says. I've tested it against the lion and the bear, and this guy is going to be just like them. Just like them. So what were his crucible moments? Out being a shepherd. Prepared him for that fight on that day. Your moments that you have, that many of us may not even know about, the things that you're fighting right now in your life, your crucible moments are preparing you for the next one. Have you ever thought, God, what are you preparing me for? What's going on that I have to do this, and the next level is going to be what? I'm scaring some of you. But let's look at this text. Let's look over at 1 Peter chapter 3. Beginning in verse 8. I'm reading from the New American Standard Version. It says, to sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you to be called, you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. All right, so when they say we're summing some things up, it's important to pay attention. So summation of this text, obviously he was talking about relationships before this, wives, husbands. And summing that up, he says, all of you be harmonious. What does that mean to be harmonious? I'm sorry? One mind, like-minded. It has nothing to do with when we sing on Sunday, right? It has everything to do with being like-minded, in the same rhythm, in the same pattern, okay? So being harmonious. Can we see how that works in relationships? Yeah, it's not hard, especially in a marriage. Harmony is a nice thing, right? It's a very, very good thing in relationships. Sympathetic. What's another word that's used there? Compassionate. And it's easy to see compassionate people, right? Not everybody has that gift for compassion, by the way, right? There are some people who are like, what, rub dirt on it, you know, whatever. But there are other people who are, it's easier for them to empathize with somebody, to put themselves in that position, say, well, but they're hurting. And this other person's like, whatever, I grew out of that, you know. And so there's a balance there, but we need people that are able to sympathize. Because when somebody's hurting, when somebody's suffering, that is their world in that moment, right? They can't really think beyond anything else, and they need somebody to come in that says, I can understand, or I know you're hurting, here's what we can do. You need those people. We need those people. We also need people that say rub dirt on it, because sometimes you just got to rub dirt on it, all right? Brotherly, kind-hearted, humble in spirit. So you can see how all of these elements in a congregation, in a marriage, in relationships work. They all help. But looking down in verse 10, we begin looking at something. Verses 10, 11, and 12. All these things so that we can be a blessing, that we are called to be a blessing. And in verse 10, he says, for the one who desires life, to love and see good days. All right, so are we paying attention? Who wants that? Not many of you guys. It's sort of weird. Who wants that? Yeah, of course, we all want that. Who does? That's the American dream, right? That's the American dream. I mean, not in so many words, but that's the American dream. The one who desires life, to love and see good days, he must what? Keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears are attent to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Some of you may have that in the text, all caps, or that's called out in some way. Do you have side column notes there? Psalm. Let's turn over to Psalm 34. This is Psalm 34, verses 12 through 15. Another pop quiz. Who wrote the majority of the Psalms? David. David the psalmist. Which is interesting, by the way. What is he known for? Or why couldn't he not build the temple? What is he known for? A man of war! Man of power and strength, right? That scares some of you guys. But what are we reading in the Psalms? Men of great faith. You're peeling back that armor of David and you're looking at his heart when you read the Psalms. Can you be both? Can you be strong and valiant in fight, but be a man after God's own heart? Yes, you can. What do we read here? As we read, you kind of peruse Psalm 34 and look over it. What are some things in here that would give me hope? What are some statements, as David thinks about his life, reflects on the things that he's gone through, what are some things, considering his relationship with God, that would give him any kind of hope while he's going through trials, while he's suffering? God delivered him. What does he say? Verse 4, what does he say? I sought the Lord and he answered me. And he delivered me from all my fears. Why do we pray? There's a lot of reasons we pray. There's a lot of reasons we pray. But you ever considered prayer as part of the reason why you have hope? I sought the Lord and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. We pray up here and we have our family prayer. And we have that list of names and concerns, but things happen. Things happen. The throne of heaven hears those names. Things may not happen the way we want them to happen, but we can be confident that God, the just God, things happen the way they need to happen. What's some other things that are going on in this psalm? Look at verse 7. Does verse 7 give you any kind of comfort? What are we talking about in verse 7? We're protected. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues them. And rescues them. Look in verse 19. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. And then verse 22. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. So here's, and the Psalms are full of this kind of language in relationship to David and his relationship with God. Many of the Psalms have sort of a prologue that give us maybe an idea of what was going on when that Psalm was written. If you asked somebody to talk about a Psalm, what's the one Psalm everybody knows? Psalm 23, we say harmoniously, right? Psalm 23. Why Psalm 23? When do you read Psalm 23? Times of turmoil? When you need comfort? When it's nice to know you're not standing alone? What does Psalm 23 say? The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. So we begin to feel, and just reading that, just saying that, if you have faith in that, does that not help? The Lord is my shepherd. Who would understand that more than David? Who was he? He was a shepherd of sheep. He was the one that was fighting the lion. He was the one that was fighting the bear. And now he knows God is my shepherd who fights for me, who encamps around me, who delivers me, who listens to me, who spends time with me. What do shepherds smell like? Sheep. Right? Because they're close. They have a relationship with the sheep. So David understands. So as you read the Psalms, read these as one who has faith and believes in them. Put your name there when you start reading these. Make them come out of your heart. Make them come out of your mouth and make them part of your life. So they help. And so as we look at Psalm 34, it's quoted here in 1 Peter. Why? To the one who desires life, to love and see good days, must keep his tongue from evil. Obviously, the Holy Spirit gives us this information. But the Psalms have always been a source of hope. The Psalms have always been a source to the heart. Peter grew up as what? As a Jew, right? They learned these things. They memorized these things. They sang them, much like we do. More so than we do. And so they knew these things. And so as you read this psalm and you read this text, but you must keep the tongue in check. All right. Anybody got that down? We can just glaze over that one. That one's not hard, right? What is James? Again, James talks about this. He devotes quite a lengthy section in chapter 3, verses 1 through 12, talking about the tongue. What's wrong with the tongue? It's unbridled. How many of you have ever been affected by words that somebody has spoken? I don't think anybody can ever, you can't go through life, you can't actually have a relationship with, if there were two people on the planet, you know, they would have affected somebody, each other somehow. So it's that human element in things. So as we look in James, what's What are they? What is the tongue compared to in this text? What are some things the tongue is compared to? A ship's rudder. We understand, you know, nautical terms here, right, here in Florida. Is a ship rudder big? I mean, depending on the size, in relationship to the size of the ship, is it the biggest part of the ship? No. But does it, is it important to the ship? If there was no rudder, would it really matter? Yeah, slightly, right? I mean, it gives us our direction. It does a lot of things for a ship, okay? It changes the course. What are some other things that it's compared to? I'm sorry?
Fire.
I was listening to some people talk about getting into, let's just say, heated discussions with their wives. The tongue can play a large part in that, right? Of course, they were talking too about, you know, just throwing things at people, at each other. That's probably another discussion for another day. The tongue can really hurt. It can burn. It can sting, right? We need to be careful how we use it. It talks about being bridling it. Now, if we put in verse 3, now if we put the bits into the horses' mouths so that they will obey us, we direct the entire body as well. And so it's the same thing there with changing the course bringing a horse under control. As you mentioned before, a horse is set aflame. A tongue is a fire. I'm sorry, I couldn't. Yes, it is. It is is indeed full of deadly poison. We need to make sure that we can be able to control that. Why do we need to control that in verse 10? For the same mouth come both blessing and cursing. Doesn't make sense, right? I mean, from the same mouth to come both blessing and cursing. That shouldn't be the case. Does a fountain send out the same opening both fresh and bitter water? Can a fig tree, my brethren, produce olives, or a vine produce figs? Nor can salt water produce fresh. And so it's either going to be one or the other. You can't really be a mouthpiece for God if your tongue is not in the right place. So if you're going to love life and see good days, the tongue needs to be under control. All right? So we understand that lesson. The tongue needs to be under control from evil, and his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. Is that one? That's sort of a no-brainer, right? That's a classic Sunday school answer. Do good, right? Do good. I'm sorry? It's always right to do right. I've heard it somewhere before. It's always right to do right. Now, in the moment, is it easy? Ask Eve. I mean, it would have been like, you just didn't have to eat the fruit, Eve. You just didn't have to eat it. But what's that temptation? In that moment, it looked so good. In that moment, Satan makes whatever it is that's in our life look so good. Like we need to do whatever that is. 20 minutes later, after you've done whatever that act is, you're thinking, why did I do that? Have you ever been there? Why did I do that? It's in that moment you get enticed by the flesh. And part of that is just, well, that's another discussion again. So we need to make sure that we're doing what's good. We must seek peace and pursue it. How many times have you sought peace? We're not talking about world peace. This is not a beauty pageant. But what are we talking about here? Blessed are the what? Peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers. Why? Huh? I'm sorry. Some of you are timidly answering that. Why? Yeah, we need to obviously to inherit the kingdom, but why are peacemakers good in a relationship? Have you ever gone head to head with somebody and man, you're going to win this thing? You're the one that's going to win, and they're the one that's going to win too, and you're going head to head. And you ever had somebody step in and say, hey guys, chill, let's work this out? Who were they in that moment? Peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers. Otherwise, we're just going to bang our heads together. Blessed are the people who can step in and say, hey guys, we need to slow this down and let's look at this. Blessed are the peacemakers. Seek peace and pursue it, even when it's hard. Add that little addendum on it. Even when it's hard. We're talking about people who are suffering. And we can understand, and we've been lectured on Roman culture and that they were not the nicest people to get along with. If you were next-door neighbors with a Roman, he would probably cut your shrubs if you didn't want him to. You know, they weren't nice people. They did more than that, but obviously tongue-in-cheek. They were not, in relationship to a Christian, they were not the nicest people. Now, we know that the persecution initially started with the Jews. It started there, and then later transitioned into Rome. But did you know the Romans never, they accused people, and we'll look at this in just a minute later in the text, but they accused Christians of cannibalism and incest. Why would they think that? Cannibalism and incest. Now, they never cited anything, but that was just what they said. Well, they're bad because of this. And let's just do whatever we want to with them. Why would they say that of Christians? The Lord's Supper, what do we eat on the Lord's Supper? Christ's body, right? We eat His flesh and we drink His blood. And when you put it that way, it's kind of gross. But they don't understand the spiritual side of what we're talking about there, obviously, right? Why would they think that we're incestuous? Because we're all brothers and sisters. Because we're all brothers and sisters. Some of you are going, oh, I get it now. Yeah. What's that? Oh, that's true, yes. Yes. So that's Rome's, what they're saying against the church. But they're to seek peace and pursue it. To seek for peace. Even when it might hurt the pocketbook, seek peace. And we're quick about our rights, correct? Well, I have rights. And I'm as guilty as the next guy, you know. I'm not going to go into my examples because I'll have to go forward. But we're quick to capitalize on, well, I'm an American, I have rights. Or I have my rights in whatever case. Have your rights ever gone in contrast with what's best for the situation? Have you ever tried to force your rights so much so that if you would just kind of lay off that a little bit, things would have eased out? You know, maybe we need to take one for the proverbial team and just kind of be defrauded so that peace can be made. In some cases, I'm not talking about, you know, give your house up. I'm just saying there are cases where maybe if we can back off a little bit, it would be best for peace. What was it that Christ prayed for in the garden? What was among other things? Do you remember what He prayed for? Unity. Peace in the church. Have there ever been issues inside the Lord's body? Do people breathe, right? There have been issues. Mundane things have split a congregation. And we've talked about the color of a carpet or, you know, whatever things have, but we need to be people to seek for peace. Why? What does the verse 12 say? Why? What should be our motivation there? What's our motivation? Among other things, what is our motivation? Verse 12, chapter 3, verse 12. Open book. Chapter 3, verse 12. Why are we motivated to do these things? Why are we motivated to do what God asks us to do? I'm sorry? He listens to our prayers. His ear is attentive to us. For God is what? For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. Is it possible that my prayer could be hindered by my lifestyle? Yes. My prayers could be hindered because of my lifestyle. All right. So verse 13, we have that section of the psalm. And then he goes into talking about, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? What does it mean to be zealous? If I'm zealous for something, you work hard at it. Are you kind of, I'm zealous for that. No, that's willing. Huh? Obsessed. Does anybody know anything, anybody in here that's zealous about any kind of hobby or anything? Yeah. What's that? An Alabama fan, yes. He's not here. We can't bring that up. It's not fair. Any food with bacon. What is up with bacon? I think that's propaganda for the bacon sellers. It's working. Bacon's good. I can't lie. So we understand the concept of being zealous for a hobby, being zealous for bacon, being zealous for many things. But what about being zealous for God? What does a life look like that's zealous for God? Can you count on them to do something? If somebody's zealous for fishing, just throwing it out there, some people are into that, and it's a nice, perfect day, the wind is calm, there's not a lot of chop out on the water, they have a boat. If that person's zealous for fishing, where do you think that person's going to be? On the water, all right? On the water, especially if snook season's in, okay? Just saying, throwing it out there. But if somebody is zealous for God, can we count on them for making the right decision? Do we know where they're going to be? Do we know the kind of lifestyle they're going to be living? So it says here in this text, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? How do you prove to be zealous? By your actions, by what you do. I will show you my faith by my works, said James. All right, so who is there among you? Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled. But sanctify Christ as Lord and in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. So here's this concept. But even if you should suffer, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were in front of the king, Nebuchadnezzar. Do you remember what they said? Almost this kind of language right here. Our God is able to save us. But even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow down to your idol. Right? God is able to save us if we prove zealous for his work. But even if we do suffer, who was the most zealous person, the most dedicated person to ever live on the face of this planet? Jesus. Excellent. Sunday school answer. Jesus. Was he zealous? Did he suffer? Even before the cross, did he suffer? Yes, he did. Should we be any better? Are we going to suffer? If we're doing what he does, if we're living like he is or was, we're going to suffer. It's just how it is. But what have we already concluded about that suffering? Huh? It has a purpose. It has a purpose. And what is that purpose? To strengthen us, to build us up, to make us stronger, to prepare us for whatever is coming next. Whatever's coming next. And some of you are like, I'm not ready for what's coming next. But you will be. You will be. Are you ever alone in those fights? No. You're never alone. Go ahead. Somebody said, okay, so you're never alone. If we need somebody physically there to be with us in the moments, who do we have? Brothers and sisters. So I need somebody to be there with me. So what do I need to do? Call them. We need to be plugged into each other's lives. Now, I'm not saying necessarily you need to call every single one and everybody. You know, some people are more equipped to deal with issues than others, and we need to be discerners of that, okay? I'm not going to call one of these guys. No offense to you guys. I'm not going to call one of them to help me with my marital issues. If I don't have any, I'm just saying. Note to self, think about examples before you say them. But you understand the concept there. We have people to help us. If you know somebody who is struggling with something, is it wrong to say, hey, I think you're struggling with this. Would you like somebody to stand with you in that? Is that wrong? That's right. It's always right to do right. I'm going to stand with you in that moment. And if you want some advice, I'm here for you. Now, getting back to the tongue concept, have you ever had uninvited, and at the moment, you didn't really like that advice? Have you ever had that before? Well, Josh, I don't think that tie goes with a striped shirt. Noted. I will change that. You know, we need to be careful with how we say things too, right? Does that matter? There's a passage in the Bible that says, I would not have you ignorant, brethren. I would not have you ignorant. And Paul talking, instructing the church. If you said that with different inflection, could it mean something else? I would not have you ignorant, brethren. Right? That's a preacher joke. Yeah. Some of you are like, I know, I can tell. So how we say things is important. How we communicate, again, going back to the concept of the tongue, but going into the concept of us working together. Was that two bells, by the way? One. Okay. First one. Never mind. So here's the concept. If we're going to be working together, we need to make sure, if we're going to love life, see good days, make sure the tongue is in check, make sure I'm doing good, make sure I'm seeking peace. And if I'm doing these things, if my life proves zealous, God's there with me. Even if it doesn't, I may still suffer. But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, and we're not talking about suffering because, why does he say suffering for the sake of righteousness? Have you ever suffered because you made a bonehead move? Okay, that's what we're talking about. I know you need to suffer because you need to learn, right? But we're talking about suffering for the sake of righteousness, all right? Do not fear them, because you will be blessed. You are blessed. In Acts chapter 5, after the apostles, Peter and the rest, have been sequestered by the temple guard and that kind of stuff, and had been flogged, and they came out, they rejoiced to be considered worthy to suffer for the cause of Christ. Acts chapter 5. That is just not in the mindset of the world. And so when the world looks at this, they're thinking, y'all are crazy. Nobody wants to suffer. Nobody wants to do these things. It's just easier to follow the track that everybody's doing. But the church in that time was going against the grain. And they're saying, no, we can't live that way. Are we doing the same thing today? Is the world at large around us, are they pretty much following in line with the gospel and the good news of Christ? No, not at all. Has that ever changed throughout history? No. I mean, maybe there are some times that were better. I think when Noah and his family was around, it was a good time for the planet, right? But just a few rainy days before that, not so good, okay? So in general, there's been issues, okay? But when we looked at this, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. To sanctify something is to set apart something for a holy use. If I sanctify Christ in my heart is for Christ. As Lord in your hearts. If somebody is Lord of something, are they sort of in control of that? In general, they should be, right? If Christ is Lord in your heart, who is he in control of or should be in control of? Or have reign over? Us. Our heart. And then we need to be ready to make a defense or give a defense to everyone who asks for the reason you have hope. And here's the thing. Here's what we're getting down to. All of that to say, despite the suffering, despite the issues that were going on, for those group of Christians that Peter is writing to, they needed to have hope and to be ready when people ask them, why do you have hope? Because you shouldn't, right? That's the other side of that coin. When people are asking, why do you have hope? Because in their mind, you shouldn't have hope. You shouldn't have it. Based on their understanding, based on what they know, you should not have hope. And you need to be ready when people ask you, why do you have hope? There's a hope that's within us. Why do you have hope? And so tonight, that's the question I want you to leave with. Why do you have hope? Are you ready to answer that question? That's what I want you to leave with tonight. That's your homework. You can jot it down. Why do I have hope, and am I ready to give an answer for that? Now, obviously, we're at various faith levels here, right? Some of us have been in the church a good long while. Some of us are sort of new in that area of building our faith. Was David, when he was an even younger man, when I don't imagine David at 12 going out to fight Goliath. He had to be ready for that. He had to be prepared for that moment. Every one of us, and God knows our limits, is being prepared for our proverbial Goliath one day. But was David standing alone? No. Will you be standing alone? No, you will not. Will your faith be tried? If you're zealous and you're doing what's right, your faith is growing. Pain is growth in the idea of faith. There are some gyms who say the same thing, but we're not talking about the physical body. We're talking about the spiritual body. And we go through those trials to help us grow and to be strong. And so tonight, you need to ask yourself, am I ready to give that answer? Do I know why I have hope? Do you have hope? Are you ready to give a defense for that? Are you ready to say, yes, this is why I have hope, and you should too? Are you ready? Any comments, questions, shout-outs? Perfect timing. You are dismissed. Thank you.